Welcome to the Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin. I'm the editor of Reaction. I'm joined by my colleagues, Maggie Pagano and Alistair Benn from the Reaction team. Loads to talk about this week. We're going to talk for about half an hour or so, we think. First, let's talk about Macron and France. You were there, Alistair, on Monday for the final round and for his great victory. What did you make of it?
Sort of two impressions, two general impressions. One of the low-key quality of the kind of campaign and the kind of feeling in Paris. When I was in a restaurant when the exit poll came out, which in France is incredibly accurate, sort of for obvious reasons, and I think we were the only people in the whole restaurant who made any kind of sort of getting your phone out to look at it. We looked around, absolutely no one was doing the same. So I think there was an element of people, you know, the polling really had gone back in Macron's favour and in the last few days, and it wasn't that surprising in the end. My second impression was reporting from Saint-Denis in the north of Paris, which is one of the banlieue. I was in La Courneuve for the afternoon of polling day, which rather oddly, given it's now full of very modernist housing estates, is where the old French kings are buried. It was the suburb where Nicolas Sarkozy famously, on going there, said he would clean it out with a Karcher hose, provoking uproar, and also where Jean-Luc Godard filmed one of his film sets.
Another of his impenetrable films. Wow.
I think this was that. It was. I can't remember the name, but it's one of the more impenetrable ones, Ian.
Really?
I've noted the cynicism, which you
Well, I've seen One Plus One, the Sympathy for the Devil film, and quite a few other films, and none of it's ever made any sense to me. They had a very good eye for recording the Rolling Stones. But anyway, sorry, interrupted
well,
you.
It was in La Courneuve, and I've never to play the banlieue now have a huge mythology to people outside France, because you learn about it in school, you watch films like La Haine or more recently Les Misérables, which was came out a few years ago about the situation in the banlieue, and it's obviously described as a parallel society in effect, where people, you know, the mainstream French culture just doesn't penetrate, and it's highly polyglot, very full of massively basically a population 70% immigrants, and yeah, I was very struck actually going there, speaking to people, mostly Maghrebian and North African, who at times were talking about the election to me as if it was happening to another people entirely. So constantly referring to les Français think this, les Français think that, this is what their culture will make them do. And I just thought it was kind of, it's not something I've ever really recognized in London so much, or I remember my main impression was thinking, you know, the French majority, they really do believe in the superiority of their values and their culture, and there is a minority in France who feels very left out, economically impoverished, in very difficult circumstances, who really are not part of the same project. And I just thought it was quite sad, and also, well, just fascinating. Anyway, so that's my reflection
and
on that.
That group and related groups that people suspect, and there have been a lot of reports on this in the last couple of weeks, that if there is civil unrest, a new phase of protest, there's always a new phase of protest in France, maybe this autumn, rooted in the cost of living crisis or diesel bills, that's where it will come from. So that's the theory. But nonetheless, Maggie, even though there are problems ahead for Macron, it's still it is still was an absolute thrashing that he delivered to Le Pen, and it is a very convincing, impressive victory. No?
Yes, no, it was, and I think that's very positive because they needed, if you like, a strong direction. What was interesting was that Macron immediately said, "I have listened," and the big question now is, you know, will he listen and to try and understand why so many people, particularly in the rural France, quite apart from the banlieue, to their grievances, which is why they were so attracted to on the far left Mélenchon and on the right Le Pen, and there was really not much difference between the two. So I think he's got to find a way to ease the problems, if you like, in the country, but also between young and old, because they're still struggling with public sector reform. He wants to put the retirement age up. Whereas, of course, Le Pen wanted to put it down. And the unions, you know, they may have, whoever voted for him, as they say in France, you can vote for Macron today, but tomorrow you'll be out in the streets protesting. So I think he's still got a lot of challenges ahead. And also, what's going to be very interesting is his relationship with Britain, which has not been great over the last few years. It's time for a sort of reset.
Yeah, but I'm not sure. I agree with you, Maggie, and there's a lot, I think, in his domestic agenda that is laudable, and some of his reforms in his first term were successful, and that you can see the possibility of a more dynamic France and a resurgent French economy. You can see that there, though there may, of course, be some form of global recession. We'll see what happens with that, and I think we're going to come on to talk about that. Yes, you're right. That's the other dimension, is the notion of Macron as the leader in Europe post his election victory. Yeah, two elements to that which really interest me. The first one is, as you said, Maggie, the relationship with Britain, which has become really bad. And interestingly, and we've talked about it before on this podcast, initially the relationship with Boris was actually rather healthy, and they had a bit of a bromance and were able to talk about French history, and Boris used his not inconsiderable charm on Macron, and they got along, and then fell out in the midst or at the height of the Brexit negotiations. And it's going to be interesting to see if in the UK government, if there is an appetite or not for a reset with France, on the basis that it might not even be available, and that Macron might not really be that bothered by attempting to reset with the UK. There's an irony in this, in that Britain and France are very close as allies on the defence front. I mean, it's in terms of operational stuff and the various treaties which are in place. The armed forces of France and Britain work very closely together, but then there's this diplomatic divergence with him having taken a very different attitude on Ukraine and talking to Putin right up until the end, and then being lied to, which the Brits predicted was the case, and not listening to British and American warnings on this. But he wants to pursue a almost a Gaullist strategy of European strategic autonomy, and with a European army, of course, which is a complete non-starter for the Northern Europeans, the Swedes, the Finns, the Poles, the Baltic countries, and also countries like Romania, who, having observed French policy in relation to Ukraine and Putin, say nothing of German policy, well, the last thing they're going to do is turn around to President Macron and say, "Look, please, can you now lead us?" Because they disagree with his fundamental analysis. So unless he shifts on Ukraine and Russia in some way, which he may do, it's difficult to see how he becomes Europe's leader. And he has a big problem with the Franco-German alliance is broken, and Scholz has huge problems within Germany because Germany is accused of getting itself of supplying insufficient aid to the Ukrainians, and the German government is split on whether and how to do more. And then Macron has his own analysis. So I don't see in all of that some kind of grand leadership position with the rest of Europe
No.
bowing down. So it's a really difficult situation.
Although, sort of counterintuitively, it might well be that a lot of his sort of threats to Britain, whether it was the fishermen in Jersey, the cutting off into, you know, the electricity supplies and all this, was sort of pre-election posturing. And maybe this has given him some confidence. And with his position in Europe, in a sense, for the reasons you just gave, weakened, it could be a good reason to be friends again with, you know, renew his bromance with Boris. Might
There's
suit them both. And the
true.
whole Rwanda thing, you know, already we're seeing the number of immigrants has reduced, but whether
Illegal
they're staying in
immigrants,
France, of course. But no, I wouldn't knock the fact that they don't get start resetting this relationship.
There's also Maggie, the possibility. You've seen how one man or woman can make such a difference in global affairs. What's happened in Ukraine is evidence of that, and the difference that leadership can make and personal chemistry between leaders. In those circumstances, they're both Macron and Boris, if it is still Boris, we'll come on to that in a moment. You can see a scenario in which they just decide to reset or have a particularly good phone call or over a bottle of wine, very good French wine, decide to try and reset, and it could come down to the personal chemistry, or Boris goes and a new British Prime Minister takes a different attitude. And it would, for example, if it was Jeremy Hunt, he would certainly try to reset. I'm not sure that the Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, would, considering she's been through the experience of French policy, having been, in British terms, perceived to be wrong-headed over Ukraine. So the personal dynamics really matter. Shall we hinted there that we're going to talk a bit about Boris and Parliament. There's no real movement on the leadership question, but I just wanted to ask you both what you make of, well, the mess in Parliament. So Partygate plus this porn business, which you don't really want to get into. I'm not sure an MP's accused of something, which I'm not sure whether said MP or minister denies it, accepts it. God knows where it all is going to lead. But it looks like, I mean, Parliament at the moment looks like one of those Channel 5 documentaries about, you know, Britain's biggest crime families or, you know, corrupt Britain. I mean, it is a really pretty sort of sleazy spectacle, isn't it, Maggie?
It's very sleazy. I don't know who it was, but somebody tweeted yesterday, if any other organisation had 56 sexual misconduct inquiries going on, the police investigating, you know, all the leaders for breach of rules and somebody watching porn, you know, you'd close the place down, wouldn't you? No, it's awful. On the fines, I think it's getting so just silly, actually, and I don't think most people really care about the detail. I'm tempted to be very radical and just call for an amnesty on all COVID fines and for anybody who's been fined over the last 2 years to be repaid and just finish it, close it down. We all know there were mistakes made. We all know some of those rules are impossible to define or to set. And the way that they're now, the Tories are now trying to stir up the Starmer, Durham, Miners Club, Rayner. It's just, we've got a huge, massive cost of living crisis.
Yeah.
NHS waiting lists are, you know, as long as they've ever been.
6 million people
really
on the waiting list.
We just don't want time. We don't have enough doctors and nurses. You know, there are so many issues to be getting on with. I just feel it's got to be laid to rest.
I'm going to write, I think, in my newsletter, if you're not a subscriber to Reaction, but you're listening to this and you want to become a subscriber, it's really straightforward. The details are below and are on the site, and you get my weekly newsletter, you get Maggie's column, you get Tim Marshall every Friday on geopolitics, you get loads of other really interesting columnists and writing from the Reaction team. So, in essence, become a subscriber. But I think I'm going to try and give my thoughts on why this really feels like a sort of fag end period in British politics. Everything feels very tired and washed out post-pandemic, and that's a very dangerous moment for a government when that perception kind of takes hold. But on the fines thing, Maggie, I'm going to slightly disagree with you in that I mean, it is unseemly and there are more important things going on. But isn't this an example of, and when I say the political class, I don't mean everyone, because there were some MPs at the time who raised concerns and peers who raised concerns about the lockdown regime, by which I mean, and obviously there had to be restrictions, but by which I mean the way in which there was very little room left for leeway, common sense, human agency, and perspective. And who is parliamentarians in both houses who allowed this stuff to happen? They enabled the government at the time, gave it enormous powers. And at the time, I remember one MP saying, well, several MPs, I remember David Davis saying as well at the time, there isn't really a parliament here. Parliamentary democracy and process is being swept aside. Understandably, perhaps in the first initial phases of the pandemic, but then it took Parliament a very long time to raise questions and doubts about the way in which the government was pursuing this strategy. So, in a way, I think there's a bit of karma or natural justice here, Alistair, in them now facing the consequences that were faced by tens of thousands of people who. Young students who were locked up, or people out walking their dog and with a friend, and someone in breach of the rules, small gathering, all this sort of crazy stuff that people were fined thousands of pounds for. Well, now the boot is on the other foot. Is that fair?
Well, I think so, and I think we've kind of gone full circle in the last 10 years. We sort of had a period where everyone was pleased for a time about the role Parliament was playing post 2017 in the sort of DUP Conservative coalition era, where Theresa May was trying to get a Brexit deal through, not enough votes. It was incredibly difficult. There were all kinds of shenanigans. Some people found that very distasteful and felt that it needed to be settled at a general election, and people were trying to stop that happening, which, to be fair, there were various attempts to try and fudge it so that, there wouldn't be a kind of eventual democratic reckoning with the referendum vote. But so there's sort of complex stuff going on there. But then since then, in the pandemic, it just feels like the House of Commons, which is it's the absolute cornerstone of modern democratic life in this country, is the place we all look to as the venue where we ha hash stuff out, where we, it's the sort of ultimate place where we think debate should happen. It took hundreds of years for people to get the vote, for people in the House of Commons, and then for working people to be represented there, and for that whole process to happen. It should be a place where people have enormous pride in their work and treat it as a almost semi-sacred place. But all these stories, whether it's the kind of the porn story or various other stories that seem to come out, show that I think that the political class doesn't quite see it that way, or there's a complacency about how they're perceived. And there was a, and that really underwrought the kind of, during the pandemic, too often it was sort of seen as an afterthought, the idea that our elected representatives would get to talk about the finer details of the legislation, which in the end, the finer details were actually incredibly important for people's lives, because we were being micromanaged to an extent. Whether you're allowed to see one person here, or have a per, you know, have one more person you can have help out for child's, taking care of children, or all these kinds of little things, which were actually the kind of fabric of the regime we were living under, were all contestable and were not all just the science. And there were lots of little things which were actually big things that there wasn't much debate over. And
They're what
that
you're
was
right.
incredibly frustrating for us. And it felt like it felt like all of that would have been much more bearable, actually, if there had been a process shown all the time, and an ongoing democratic
And there
process.
wasn't, and but there were again, I stress, there were a handful of MPs at the time who were deeply concerned about it and spoke out about it. But this is, you know, this is the period when, remember all that drone stuff about, you know, people, you know, out on the hills walking, being warned by the police of Derbyshire case, exactly, Maggie. Mm-hmm. And then remember the footage, remember the overhead, the drone footage of people being stopped by the police, or not stopped by the police, being questioned by the police because they were sitting down on a park bench on their own, you know, taking in the view, and they were asked to move on. And this is the culture that this is the climate that 65 million people were supposed to live with and accept. And when that stuff happened and was all over the TV, it was not then followed by an urgent question in the House of Commons, which wasn't really meeting, it was meeting virtually, and that made it very difficult for the opposition or for MPs to challenge. But there should have been a clamour from inside Parliament, from the opposition party as well, saying hold on, the rules are there to be interpreted with a little bit of common sense, surely. That didn't happen because a lot of politicians, the vast majority of politicians, didn't want to be seen to be on the wrong side of clapping for the NHS, endorsing the, you know, the save lives, obey the rules culture. And now they find, as I said, there's maybe a bit of revenge involved. Can I pose a question to you, Maggie, just on the COVID point, which is China's got a series of lockdowns, really strict, draconian lockdowns. The footage and the reports from Shanghai are quite extraordinary. What's all this doing to global trade? Because we've seen the figures in the US this week on the possibility of a recession, all sorts of things flashing, potential recession warning lights flashing in the UK and in other parts of Europe as well. Is that connected to China struggling to export or to manufacture and export because of the lockdowns, or is it unclear at this stage?
No, I think it's fairly clear that there's a strong connection. To what extent is difficult to ascertain now, but I think for a couple of months now that we have seen that China's growth is slowing down quite quickly, and that forecasts for its overall growth this year is down by about 3%. And it's a combination of all these factors. It was number one, the supply chain disruptions, ships not being able to leave the ports, but also what you happened once we came out of lockdown, demand, if you remember in the summer of 21, suddenly went soaring up. But of course, all the factories hadn't been working for several months. So they just didn't have the capacity to produce their output. And then the raw materials, they weren't able to get them. So many of the factories are running out of coal, which is, I think, it's about 60% of all China's energy is still coal. So it's a multiple factors. But this latest lockdown in Shanghai certainly had a big effect. I think that from what I'm reading in the trade press, that the main port, Yantian, is part of the free trade area, bringing everything out of Shanghai. That's now sort of working back more or less back to normal. But the COVID restrictions has such a, you know, long tail, because it's the truck drivers who are being caught and stopped for COVID testing, and people not allowed out of their homes and so forth. So it has a multiplier effect. And yes, absolutely. And therefore, in the US, demand is going down. They can't get the products. And with any hope, once the supply chains get moving again, with any luck, we might see prices coming down because raw commodity prices will come back down to earth a bit. Yeah. Having said that, we haven't even mentioned Ukraine and Russia and the impact, of course, Ukraine being breadbasket of Europe, and not just wheat, but potash and fertilizers, all the sorts of things that most people don't even think about go into their everyday foodstuffs. So yeah, we're in a bit of a mess, really.
I just had a question for you, Maggie, on rates, on interest rates. Yeah. Just before we're going to talk about the war in a moment, but do you think that, so take the Bank of England, having been quite slow to react, do you think that they're now and there has this has happened at various points in history, that when a if you're caught behind, if you're behind the curve on inflation, and then you really you have the tool of hiking interest rates to try and tackle inflation, though there's a dispute about to what extent that would work, because it's really it's about supply and shortages. Who knows? But do you think there's a possibility that they're going to surprise people, the Bank of England, by changing course and overhiking or trying to do something, almost exaggerating for effect, for impact, and that the hikes could be bigger than people think?
No, I don't. That would be my gut. Probably proved totally wrong. They've done three hikes now, haven't they, since last over the last few months. There is a school of thought, as you say, put it up 1%, just get the, you know, the pain over and done with. But Andrew Bailey's last comments were, what are you more terrified of, inflation or tipping us into recession? And that's what they're trying to balance out.
It's not like the situation in the US in the late 70s, early 80s, where you had the Fed, which was really just determined, having been so spectacularly wrong on inflation during that decade, and then sort of stunned by what happened to, you know, with the oil price and remaking the global financial system, that they were just completely determined to get ahead of it, and just took the view that you just have to, the economy just has to take the pain. You just have to get inflation out of the system. It doesn't feel like that is an Andrew Bailey
No.
approach, or that there's political pressure to do that. So they'll, you think they'll err on the side of
Of
try
course.
not to crash the economy,
Yeah.
try to avoid a recession.
I think another 0.25%, do it gradually. I mean, we saw what will it put up? Another 0.25% put up mortgages. People who haven't fixed by what, 700 to 1,000 a year. You add on the energy costs, which are perhaps 2,000 to 3,000 more a year, and yeah, and then the national insurance rises. I think it'd be too much. Too much.
So let's talk for a few minutes about the war, Alistair. You had a concern on the back of Liz Truss, Foreign Secretary's speech at Mansion House was this week, so a big set piece foreign policy speech from the UK government. You had some concerns that she was, in essence, expanding the war aims.
Yeah, well, I think almost a little bit under the radar, in the terms of the actual debate, I mean, or lack of democratic debate we're having about this. Our aims have shifted in the last week, for various reasons that are good reasons, in principle, but sort of taken together, sort of concern me about the sort of direction we're now going in. So, the idea now is we're moving beyond the kind of first stage, defensive stage. We're kind of matching Putin saying, the Russians saying, we're in a new stage where we're going for shifting to the east and going for Donbass and Donetsk and Luhansk. And as part of that shift, we're now committing to sending heavier weapons, more interventionist weapons, aeroplanes, as Liz Truss said, and our aims are also more ambitious. It's the Ukrainians might, you know, not just be able to hold where they are, but potentially push Russia back through the territory in the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic, and even potentially the kind of implication is Crimea, and that's the basis the West is saying that Putin will be allowed to negotiate from. Going back to the 2014 borders, and that's when negotiations will be allowed to happen in effect. I think that is, you know, there we can have various views about maximalist goals in Ukraine, and but I have concerns that we're not talking. That's a huge deal, you know, that, and we're not talking about that enough. And I think there needs to be more than just a Mansion House speech by Liz Truss. I think this needs to be talked about in Parliament. We need to have Keir Starmer, his people in his foreign policy brief, working out what they think about this. Is this the right thing to do? Is this potentially escalating the war into a place where we cannot control the escalation. There are lots of things that worry me. Also, realistically, again, anyone who knows anything about Ukraine and the last 8 years, the war in and what's happened in Donbass for the last 8 years, will feel very skeptical that pushing Russia all the way back to the 2014 borders would either be achievable without inflicting massive costs on civilian life, or just straightforwardly achievable and unsustainable, and it would be something that would be incredibly difficult to manage going forward. You'd need huge peacekeeping forces. You would need involvement from other military other than Ukraine to do that. The idea of pushing them out of Crimea, that's another thing altogether. That, you know, Crimea, since the 90s, ever since Ukraine has become a sovereign country, there have been separatist issues. The political culture in Donbass, you know, it's always been recognized that for some sort of sustainable solution to happen in Donbass, there would have to be a large degree of devolution from Kyiv, not necessarily Russian. It's a peculiar place. It's one of the only places in Ukraine where, for the decade after the collapse of the Soviet Union, people still tended in polling to describe themselves as Soviet over Russian and Ukrainian, which was different to the rest of the Ukraine, because this is the industrial. The Donbass is a huge Soviet mythology. It's one of the most sort of mythologized places in Russia as the place of its heavy industry, the miners. It's a whole emotional thing that we kind of miss that makes it very specific. Yeah. And I think it's just all of that. If we go back and think, what are we trying to achieve? We want to help the Ukrainians defend themselves against a terrible aggressor, and we want to get them into a position where Putin cannot solely dictate terms, and there can be a diplomatic solution between the two parties. That strikes me as still the right strategy, in spite of everything. But we're moving to a different one.
I see what you mean on escalation, but I think what her speech revealed is that I think there's a, I would see if it works, but I think there's a different Western strategy emerging, and whether or not it's entirely successful arming Ukrainians as much as the West can, and trying to, as you describe, Alastair, force it out of areas that might not originally have been thought possible. I think they're taking the view that you try and do as much of that as possible in the next phase of the war, because, my suspicion is that they're operating on the basis that there won't be peace talks, and that you're moving towards a new international dispensation that looks quite different from what happened before the war. And the assumption that eventually both sides fight themselves to some kind of standstill, there is then a peace brokered by, well, who? Presumably the United Nations. But if you read the Truss speech, it essentially says, and I think she's right in this, is that the international system failed catastrophically in the run-up to Ukraine. It can't be the basis on which there is some sort of settlement which partly rewards Putin. I think the most interesting thing in her speech is the start, and there's a lot of really interesting ground which fits, as Tim Marshall said on Reaction, with how the Americans see things, is that I think you're moving towards a G7 world, and the G7 as an institution, which Truss wants and the British government wants to become a much bigger and more important institution with a permanent secretariat, and now that's the G7 countries plus the EU, represented by von der Leyen, president of the Commission. That's about 50% of the global global GDP, and that then becomes potentially the G7 plus friends becomes the key global body representing the West and the democracies. And of course, that includes Japan as a member of G7. In those terms, the idea that every war finishes with a negotiation, a phrase you hear a lot, which is actually not true, and there are lots of wars that have finished with defeat or a standoff where you don't necessarily have a have a peace treaty or a settlement. You simply have a frozen conflict. I think that that's where they're getting to. It's just a supposition on my part and a suspicion that I think they'll want to help Ukrainians, push the Russians as far out as they can, and then essentially try and lock the space and then flood NATO territories, which is already happening, but Poland, and then when Sweden and Finland join, arming NATO countries or rearming them to the teeth and resisting Russian, essentially being a deterrent against Russia. But I don't think there is some kind of peace deal or trade after which we go back to a version of a sort of new normal dealing with Russia or Putin's Russia. So that's my take on it.
And the problem is, I agree that that's clearly what seems to be emerging. I just think that there will be more of a debate between European capitals about that,
Yes.
and there will be different views, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. I think people will, that's the strength of democracies. They can have different, come to different views about
True. And did
common
during this
threats.
did during the Second World War. That's true, actually. And within the Allies, there were disputes, and Macron, who we began this podcast with, will take a different view. You'd imagine,
Exactly.
even as a member of G7, he'll see a bigger role for, well, his leadership, Franco-German position, and some kind of trade-off with Putin. But I don't think the Northern Europeans, who are increasingly significant and important in this, will sign up to that. And interestingly, another theme not much picked up on in the UK, but is track what the Italians and the Spanish are saying, which is the Italian position, and Italy has a long, interesting, complicated relationship with Russia, but the Italian position has become much more robust on the NATO front. So we'll see. Maggie.
One thing I would just say, sorry to cut in, but the is, and again, I'll put myself a hostage to fortune slightly here. I think that all makes sense if the Ukrainians do continue to hold or make advances, and I think there are some quite worrying signs coming
Yes.
out that the Russians, a lot of the Ukrainians who are now fighting in Donbass. There's a lot of sort of people who've been called up. It's not reported in the Western press for obvious reasons that there are casualties that happen
Yes.
to Ukrainian forces. They are suffering losses. The Russians, are to some degree or another getting their act together to and that will tell. The Russians will be learn, for all the terrible problems generated by the bureaucracies they have and the way it's structured and the way things go emanate from the top and the inability to have responsibility. The Russians will have learned a lot from the last couple of months about their own capabilities, about what works and what doesn't. And you could see a situation where the sort of sheer numbers of Russian soldiers, which looked like 3-1, end up turning it and pushing the Ukrainian forces back, and you get some
Possibly.
situation where the Donbass and the whole of the Black Sea, which is a major propaganda win for Putin, the idea that you unite all the Russian-speaking peoples of the
Yeah.
Black Sea into Mother Russia, is a potentially a huge 9th of May victory parade thing to announce, including potentially Odessa, which is a sort of jewel city, and for
Well, yeah.
place of great culture and beauty. All that stuff could, there are sort of alternative realities at play here.
True, and it's possible that we're recording this on Friday the 29th of April. So if that scenario develops, then you're probably thinking about the 9th of May next year. And he is digging in and he's preparing for a long conflict. But then there are other interesting, curious straws in the wind, aren't there? These reports this afternoon that Putin himself has taken over running the war directly, and he's essentially given all other Russian policy, the economy, everything else, just said to the prime minister, handle it, and that he's hands-on with the war. Now, as various military historians have pointed out, that there's not a, in military history, that tends not to end well when a leader who's not a military strategist themselves might think he is, intervenes, takes over and tries to run the war from a distance. That's not a sign necessarily that things are going well. But maybe you may be right, Alistair, and it does now look as though this phase two really heralds what could be a long war, certainly a war stretching into the autumn and maybe beyond. Maggie, I'm really just going to wrap up now, but is there anything you want to add on the war and Ukraine? We haven't mentioned, of course, our conference, the Defence of Europe conference, which is happening at Bush House, co-hosted by Reaction at King's College London on the 9th of May. The date was picked purely as a coincidentally, although it is a date marked in Russia. But we're meeting on that day at Bush House with some a fantastic lineup of military experts, commentators, the defense secretary speaking, and really just want to reiterate the call that there are not many tickets left. Actually, we've been inundated with responses, and we're trying to ensure that Reaction subscribers get tickets. So if you are listening to this and you're a Reaction subscriber, email us if you still want to come, and you'll be there, Maggie, on the day as well with
Absolutely.
the whole Reaction team.
We will. We'll be reporting from it.
Yes.
Just adding in on your previous discussion, the fear of if you like, a strengthened G7, you could say it's always been there, but there's a new sense of purpose, isn't there? And an attempt perhaps to almost replace the UN is sort of what you can see out of this. The fear here must be that Putin then is driven so far into a corner if he's given no room to negotiate. And we know what happens when people get fearful, and especially if he's running the military, that he presses the button. Surely you have to leave some way out, and one can only hope. And we've heard in the last few days that apparently China is playing perhaps a slightly bigger role than we might be reading from the mass press. But yeah, that would be my observation on that tactic.
Two things have to be true, right? If you the idea we are obviously, the story is Putin and the leadership around him are brutal people who will do anything to survive and will use
Yes.
any means at their disposal to achieve that, and will be brutal, and they're accountable to no one. That is true about the nature of the power vertical which rules Russia. They also have access to a range of nuclear weaponry, which is second only to NATO's arsenal, which has lots of smaller nukes, so-called tactical nukes, which have a smaller fallout area, and also the kind of world-ending intercontinental ballistic missiles. That unfortunately is the reality we're working with. We're not encircling a rogue state like Saddam's Iraq
Yeah,
or
understood.
Kim Jong-un's North Korea. This is, this is a country which has borders with about a quarter of the world's population. It's a different thing.
It's a
So.
different proposition. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Alistair. It's a good reminder. I wasn't what I was mapping out there. I'm not predicting or saying that it's predestined to succeed, but there is some sort of regeneration of the West happening, and I think you saw this week really striking, actually, just that way in which Truss focused on G7, and I think they're on to something, and that will be the basis for Western response. But let's see. You've been listening to the Reaction podcast with me, Ian Martin, editor of Reaction, and with Maggie Pagano and with Alistair Benn. Until next time, thank you very much for listening.